Okay, so as an appetizer, I'll be talking about some model building to try to discuss dark energy. And by that, I mean basically cosmological constant and quintessence. And so the idea is just to try to present some of the models and to put them in perspective. And that's more or less intended for an audience who is more interested into observations and really model building. Well, first of all, what are the problems to solve? The problems are energy physicist problems. There is no real problem as far as astrophysicists are concerned about the cosmological constant, but just because you can set it to zero or set it to any value. The problem arises when you try to do some quantum theory of fundamental interactions, in the sense that the cosmological constant problem is more like a vacuum energy problem. So I just remind you of this. If you have some non-vanishing vacuum energy, then this gives you some effective cosmological constant. And this is really the problem, because you have to explain why the vacuum energy has value that it has, which is basically, well, given orders of magnitude, is the limit is being set up by something of order the Hubble parameter squared. So that means that the scale associated with vacuum energy, I'm now talking about a mass scale associated with vacuum energy, that's something to be smaller than 10 to minus 30 times the Planck scale, which is something like 10 to minus 3 electron volts. And somehow you have to dig into, erase such a vacuum energy. You have to dig into the fundamental theory, such a scale. So that's one problem. The second problem is the cosmic coincidence problem. Why this vacuum energy is emerging now, if it is. I will not be reviewing the observational part of all this, because that was covered in the meeting 2 weeks ago. So let's assume that it's emerging at this point. So why is it emerging now? Of course, as soon as you start asking this type of questions, then you're begging for an anthropic. I mean, you have to say what is now, and so you're begging for an anthropic interpretation of this. So one way to avoid any reference to us is to ask the following question. Because the cosmological constant energy density is constant by definition, whereas the matter energy density is decreasing, so the question really is, why does the energy start to dominate at a time which almost coincides with the epoch of galaxy formation, at least over the complete evolution of the universe? And so that's summarized here. Matter radiation equality, and then soon after, you start having us and the vacuum energy seems to be, well, whatever, this seems to be dominating. So those are the two, basic problems that we should try to understand, and those are really, problems of energy physicists more than, as I said, astrophysicists. And one way to try to get one special symmetry when one discusses vacuum energy is supersymmetry. And so let me try to explain in a couple of transparencies why. We are all used to quantities which are conserved in interactions. One is electric charge. Another one is a vector quantity, that's the energy momentum, and that's related to the invariance by translation. Angular momentum, a tensor quantity, is related to the invariance by rotation. And it was thought until the 70s that actually those two were the only two tensor quantities or tensor vector quantities. That means conserved quantities in interactions which transform non-trivially under the Lorentz group. Until it was realized, and this was known as the Kolmogorov-Mandela theorem. until it was realized that there is an exception to that, and that exception is a quantity which is a tensor quantity, a spinor quantity, and that's associated with a new symmetry, which is supersymmetry. I'm just restating that just to show you that supersymmetry is really playing some sort of special role, and it's really the exception to this theorem. So that means that besides vector quantity, which is an energy momentum, an angular momentum, another charge which is conserved and which is a spinor charge is associated with a new symmetry, which is supersymmetry. And so that shows the really special role of supersymmetry. And the second thing, which is that supersymmetry is a space-time transformation. It's really just like, you know, translation or rotation. That's also a space-time transformation. And one way to see this is if you start with boson field and transform it by supersymmetry into a fermion field, and then if you do a second supersymmetry transformation, then you'll find the same boson as before, but translated in space-time. And so that shows you again that supersymmetry is a space-time transformation. And that is summarized in this formula, which is just the basic algebra of supersymmetry, which basically tells you that when you take two supersymmetry transformations, you get a space-time translation. And you know, this type of algebra has some important consequences as far as we're concerned here. One of them is that the Hamiltonian of the system is given by the sum of the supersymmetry charges squared. And so that means that if you're looking for vacuum energy, which is just the value of the Hamiltonian in the vacuum, which is vanishing, then this is just simple quantum mechanics. Since this is a sum of squared, this is vanishing if and only if supersymmetry annihilates, the supersymmetry charges annihilate the vacuum. That means if only if the vacuum is supersymmetric invariant. And so that's why we're saying that supersymmetry is related to the problem we're discussing here, just because the vacuum is invariant under supersymmetry if and only if the vacuum energy, for as the cosmic constant, vanishes. So if you want supersymmetry, it's really the symmetry that tells you that the cosmological constant will be vanishing. It tells you other things, like the fact that the Hamiltonian commutes with the supersymmetry charges, and that means that if two states are transformed by supersymmetry into one another, that means that the energy levels will be the same. And so if you have a boson and a fermion, which are supersymmetric transformed of one another, that means that the levels, the energy levels, the masses, will be equal. And so the second, second consequence of supersymmetry is that bosons and fermions associated by supersymmetry are degenerate in mass. This is not observed in nature, so that means that supersymmetry, if it has any meaning at the level, if it's a symmetry, it's a hidden symmetry, what is known as spontaneous broken symmetry. And so that means that when you get back here, that means that if you need to break supersymmetry in order to have non-degenerate bosons and fermions, that means that you don't have a rationale as to why the cosmological constant should be zero. If it's not zero, that might be a welcome feature. The problem, which is a basic problem for us high energy physicists, is the following. We know that to each boson there is a fermion associated, and we know that we have some limit on supersymmetric particles. So that means if you take the electron, you're searching for the supersymmetric partner of the electron, you don't find it. So you put some limit on the mass of the supersymmetric electron. That limit is of the order of, say, 100 GeV, or depending on the type of particles, a few hundred GeV. So that means that the scale associated with the breaking of supersymmetry is in the ballpark of a few hundred GeV. And so that means that the scale, if you go around here, if you break supersymmetry, that means that this is non-zero. If you break supersymmetry, this is non-zero. And if this is non-zero, the typical scale has to be the same as this one, in principle, if you don't decouple the two scales. And so that would mean that you would expect energy scale associated with vacuum energy of the order of a few hundred GeV. And I told you that the limit is something like more 10 to minus 3 electron volts. So that's, you know, the basic problem. But at least supersymmetry is a symmetry that, global supersymmetry is a symmetry that would allow you to explain vanishing cosmology of constant. Now, if you couple supersymmetry with gravity, and that's what we have to do when we discuss the early universe, then we have to make it a local symmetry. That means the symmetry transformation can be different in different points of space-time. And in this case, you have to introduce a graviton field, which is good. That means that you have to, you're just coupling it to gravity. And its supersymmetric partner, which is the gravitino. And it turns out that when you do that, then this nice relation between vanishing vacuum energy and supersymmetry is lost. And the reason is that basically you can trade off a constant vacuum energy. I wrote it this way, but that's a constant term in the action, so that's a constant vacuum energy for a gravitino mass. And so the sign of breaking, once you couple it to gravity, the sign of breaking is no longer the fact that the vacuum energy should be non-vanishing, but it's the fact that the gravitino mass should be non-vanishing. What you can understand here, if these two are supersymmetric partners, a sign that supersymmetry is broken is certainly, this guy is always massless because the force is as infinite range, a gravitational force has infinite range, and so the sign that supersymmetry is broken, well, it's a clear sign that supersymmetry is broken if this guy acquires a mass. And actually, this is the order parameter for the breaking of supersymmetry coupled to gravity, what we know as local supersymmetry or supergravity. And so, in a way, it's a good sign because that means that we can still recover supersymmetry even if the vacuum energy is not vanishing. On the other hand, we are losing the rationale for having a vanishing or a very small cosmological constant. Now, this is the general discussion. It must be said that in some models, then you can still recover some sort of association between a supersymmetric vacuum and a vanishing vacuum energy. And one example of such thing, which happens all the time in a supersymmetric model, is the notion of a flat direction. You usually have a potential energy which depends on many fields, many scalar fields, and it quite often happens, and that's sort of, the theory is sort of reminding itself of the global supersymmetric case. It quite often happens that you find a valley of the potential energy which extends all the way to infinity, and along this valley, the value of the ground state energy is vanishing. And that is known as the flat direction. And supersymmetric supersymmetric theories or supergravity theories, or for that matter, string theories, are full of such flat directions. And so, of course, you know, people have thought of using this, you know, both for inflation and for quintessence. I'll come back to that. Once you break supersymmetry, you might raise, you know, this flat direction, and you might use this approximately flat direction when supersymmetry is broken to for cosmological purpose. Okay, just a couple of words about strings, because that will be the motivation of some of the models that I'll be presenting. You have to remember that strings were first considered as flux tubes. When you take a quark and an anti-quark and you try to take them apart, then because the interaction becomes strong, and because of confinement, the flux tube associated with a strong interaction, so the line of fluxes turn into a flux tube, and if in its first avatar, the string theory was actually trying to discuss, to describe, you know, these flux tubes. So this leads to form an open string, says, you know, which connects this quark and this anti-quark, with a typical mass scale of the order of a GeV. And it was found out that in order to be consistent, the description has to include also closed strings. And the idea is that, you know, this open string can make loops, and the loop can detach. And in order to be consistent, you have to include closed strings. Now it was found out that among the massless modes of this closed string, you have massless resonances of spin 2, which could be interpreted as a graviton if you completely change your mind and if you turn this scale into the Planck scale. And so this was the birth of string theory as a theory of gravity, trying to get this all coupled to reconcile somehow. And it makes sense only in the case of more than four space-time dimensions. So you need some extra space-time or internal dimensions. Okay, as far as I'm concerned here in this talk, string theory is really a laboratory for new concepts. And so you have many scalar fields, and which are often associated with flat directions. You have one, which is called the dilaton, which is associated with string coupling. You have moduli fields, which are associated with radii of a general form of the compact manifold that describes the extra dimensions. And that often leads to scalar tensor theories of gravity, at least as long as you don't you have not stabilized these fields. It turns out that these fields are associated with flat directions. And so this field can move along the flat direction. And one of the problems associated with these models is that if you don't pay attention to it, then because these fields are coupled to the curvature, they lead to scalar tensor theories of gravity. And so if you want to recover, at least at late time, general relativity, then you need to sort of stabilize these fields. This means that you need a structure in the flat direction that would stabilize the field in some place. There's also the idea of brains, which are the place of endpoints of open strings. So you could remember. And so that leads to the brain setup, which is, you know, which has been used and overused recently in the context of cosmology, and the idea that quarks and leptons, if you want ordinary matter plus ordinary gauge interactions like light, photon, gluons, etc., are living on this lower dimensional surface, say for example a three-dimensional surface. And then gravity is not localized on that brain, and it's everywhere in the higher-dimensional universe, which is what is called the bulk. And that leads to the possibility that actually supersymmetry. It could be that the bulk is supersymmetric, and that I told you before that supersymmetry was broken just because we see that. There is no, for example, we haven't seen yet a supersymmetric partner to the electron. So it could very well be that if all matter and supersymmetric matter is localized on the brain, that it actually the brain is not supersymmetric, but the rest of the bulk is supersymmetric. So that leads to some models trying to understand this problem of the cosmological constant through supersymmetric bulk. Because after all, the only thing that we know in this picture is that supersymmetry is broken on this surface. Do you want me to stop for a few minutes? Say that again.
Thinking about where the supersymmetry breaking. What is the supersymmetry breaking?
Yeah, that's. Well, it could be that the structure of the brain itself is such that it's breaking supersymmetry.
Yeah.
Or it could be that it's a field which is localized on the brain, which is. breaking supersymmetry. But as I'll come back to that, because that's not completely satisfactory in any case, I think. Well, in this case, the dilaton, the dilaton is part actually of the gravity, so the dilaton is everywhere in this case. Now, of course, you could imagine that the dilaton has some localized interaction, and it's really that thing that breaks through supersymmetry on the brain. No, that's okay. I'll have it later. I know that cold pizza is the fate of the seminar speaker in this type of.
Chris.
Okay, so this was the introduction, as a matter of fact. So you see how. Now comes the solutions. Well, actually, I don't have any solutions. It's why there's a question mark. Well, in the case of, if you believe that we know the reacceleration of the universe that one seems to observe is due to vacuum energy, then I'll be discussing some models which are known as models of relaxation of a cosmological constant. So if you want, it's a sort of cosmological constant that relaxes to either vanishing value or a small value. And that tends to give you, in green I put sort of observable things that you one might imagine. That tends to lead to violation of Lorentz invariance. And quite often it even leads to too strong violation of Lorentz invariance. Then if you try to understand the problem of cosmic coincidence, then it's easier treated with models of quintessence. And that tends to lead to time variation of constants and violations of the equivalence principle. Let me be more specific on some examples.
Yeah, what's the distinction you're making between the two things, relaxation and quintessence? What is this distinction?
Well, I'll be calling quintessence a scalar field that is moving in its potential.
Yeah, but what is the first thing? What is the relaxation?
I'm going to describe some of the relaxation models, so maybe that will be more clear. Okay, first of all, there is a no-go theorem due to Steve Weinberg. He is almost a complete proof of his theorem. I'm not going to go through the proof of it, just to show you that it's at least superficially a fairly straightforward theorem. What Weinberg's no-go theorem tells you is that it's not possible to have a vanishing cosmological constant as a consequence of the equations of motion of some fields. And, that's basically this, relaxation business, that you try to put some fields in such a way that the cosmological constant is going to decrease with time as an effect of the motion of these fields. Well, okay, now if I take this definition of relaxation, then probably quintessence is also some sort of relaxation. So I'm not going to go through, you can find it in a very nice review by Steve Weinberg in Review of Modern Physics of something like 5 or 6 years ago. There are some key assumptions in the proof. One of them is Lorentz invariance. This is why in any solution of a problem that uses relaxation, you might expect some violations of Lorentz invariance, and also the fact that you have a finite number of fields. And I'll be discussing theories with an infinite number of fields, like ion-dimensional theories, for example, which have the Kallmann-Zeckline modes, an infinite tower of Kallmann-Zeckline modes. So, but still, this is an important theorem because it tells you, first of all, where not to look at, and second, that since it's a no-go theorem, of course, there are ways of evading them. Okay, here are a few models that have been proposed to try to relax the cosmological constant down to zero. I'm not going to talk about the Dolgov compensation mechanism. It uses some massless vector fields or even tensor fields. I forgot to say it was a return transfer, but I didn't say that in string theory you find lots of tensor fields. And it has been shown by Rubakov, I'm just pointing this out, that this leads to too strong violation of Lorentz invariance. So, that's an example where, you get rid of this mechanism just by showing that the breaking of Lorentz invariance is just too strong. There is a very nice proposition by Brown and Teitelbaum, which is known as the Brown-Teitelbaum mechanism, which has been used in the context of elaborated in the context of string theory, and partly by Joe here. So Joe might answer any question about that. Let me just tell you what's the Brown-Teitelbaum mechanism, because that's a very nice mechanism. Well, I'll just start with. So it's not a new proposal since they proposed it in 87, but it has got a nice illustration in the context of strings. Just imagine a 1+1 dimensional model. That means you're just living on the line, and so there is one special dimension and one time. And just imagine that in this one special dimension, you have some constant one-dimensional electric field. Then we all know from school that the energy density associated with an electric field is 1/2 E squared. So that means that if there is a vacuum electric field, you have a vacuum energy density, which is, I call E0, which is thus just 1/2 E0 squared. So you live in a nice one-dimensional universe with a cosmological constant. But then in this universe, you could have pair creation. So here is a pair creation, supposing that this is a quantum process, of course. You create a pair minus Q plus Q, where Q is positive. Then, of course, the electric field in between the two charges is screened by the charges. And it's if E0 is positive and if Q is positive, it has a value which is just E0 minus Q. So that means that if you're in this part of your very simple space-time, the vacuum energy is no longer 1/2 E0 squared, but it's 1/2 E0 minus Q squared. And so it's smaller. And then the process can repeat on and on and on. You have another, in this part of space-time, you have another pair which is produced, and then the field in between the two is still a bit smaller, by Q again, the charge. And so the vacuum energy is smaller, and so on. And so if you end up down there, then you end up in a very small, in a part of universe which has very small vacuum energy. Now, when does that stop? Well, that stops when the electric field becomes smaller than the charge over 2. And the way to understand this is that just imagine you're here and you have produced, again, a pair minus Q plus Q. Of course, the electric fields must be such that this Q is accelerated to the right. Otherwise, it falls back into the minus Q. And so you can easily check that on the world line of this charge, the electric field has to be positive, and the electric field is just the sum of these two. And so that's how you find this condition. In other words, as soon as this condition is satisfied, then you could pair create, but then the two charges are not getting separated more and more, but then are falling back into one another. So if you want this nice relaxation mechanism is working until the electric field has this value, or a value of this order, in which case it stops, and so you have you get the corresponding value for the vacuum energy. Now, okay, this is a one-dimensional example. In the case of three dimensions, then you'd have, well, basically the same thing, except that you have to, you know, blow up all the dimensions. So you start with a universe with a cosmic constant, positive, in order that it's, and you have a possibility of creating a charge membrane, and inside, but of course, because you're changing the dimensions, you have to replace your electric field in this simple example by a tensor field. So in the case of a free dimension, that would be just a free tensor. And the same thing, it just, you know, if you have understood this example, then this is the same. You may have quantum creation of a bubble corresponding to the charge membrane inside the field associated with the tensor field would be a smaller value, and so the cosmic constant will be, vacuum energy will be smaller, and so on. You might have another bubble, and so on. And the process again stops when the field has a value of the order of a charge. Now, of course, the problem of this is that that would mean that if we're living today in a universe with a very small cosmological constant, we have been going through some phases where the cosmological constant was bigger and bigger and bigger. So that means that if we don't do anything, we're living in empty space, because just imagine you started, I can take this, you started with this, the vacuum energy was big at this point, so that was inflation. And so you're coming from a place where there was, you know, lots of different phases of inflation. And so you might end up in a place where the cosmic constant is small, but there's nothing else. And so you have to couple this type of models with some reheating models where you, at the end of the process, you're really, you know, putting matter back into it.
So is this a continuous process, or is it?
No, because it stops there.
No, I mean before that, before it gets there, from the.
It's just a quantum. It's a succession of, you know, quantum creations of membrane of bubbles, if you want.
But it's not a punctuated equilibrium. It happens constantly over time, right? So the cosmological constant is smoothly decreasing.
Yes. Yes. Well, yeah. It's.
I don't think it doesn't sound like the cosmology we know, does it?
Well,
sounds like more.
That would be, of course, some you know, early, very early universe.
Even before inflation.
Yeah. Because you need at the end,
zero,
yes.
The
so that's why you need, the last phase, which would be inflation, would reheat and give you, you know, matter back into your universe.
Yeah, but I mean, the energy density of the universe always increases, doesn't it? So if it's a early stage, you have the cosmological constant at -3 V, you never going to get back up to the required high energy.
That's a question for Joe.
I mean, right, you have to relax down not to zero, but to the top of the inflationary potential, where you secretly know that you're going to you have to be lucky that you land in this place where you're going to eventually end up at zero, not where you. Yeah.
Well, that's certainly a problem with this type of scenario. So
it requires some sort of anthropic selection.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that.
Well, you've got to be honest. I don't know any way to make relaxation work purely dynamically.
Yes. Well, that's right.
Without giving rise to a completely empty universe.
Now, one of the problems of this scenario is that it, the other problem is that it requires some very small charge. And you can see it here. You know, the process stops when the electric field, when the field is of the order of a charge. And so just imagine that you started with a very large cosmological constant. Then you have to end up, if you want to end up with a very small cosmological constant on these scales, then that means that the charge associated with, you know, your membrane or whatever, has to be very small. And so this requires some very small membrane charges. And so that's one of the problems of this scenario, which you have to address. And that's neatly addressed in the context of strings. So several groups have proposed that in the context of strings. And the reason is that you need some tensor field, as I was telling you, in a realistic number of dimensions. And you have plenty of tensor fields, like free-form fields, in string theory. So why not use them? And that was a proposal of two groups. So then, once you're working in the context of string theory, then you still have to explain why you have so small charges for the membranes. So one group proposed, that's usually what you do when you have a small number. You say not better with effects. Joe and Raphael Busso proposed to use not only one form, but several of them. And you can easily show in this case that even with a small number of them, you don't need to fine-tune so much the membrane charge, and that you need a small membrane charge, but not as small as in the case of a single field. Okay, another sort of relaxation mechanism which has been proposed is in the context of brain universes. So, in this context, I'm assuming that matter and radiation and so on is living on the brain with tension sigma. The tension is nothing but the vacuum energy on the brain. And gravity is everywhere else. And in this simple toy model, there is just a single extra dimension. And there is some vacuum energy in the bulk. Now, the whole problem of a cosmological constant is receiving a sort of twist in this case, because actually what you measure as a cosmological constant on the brain. So you have to remember that all the galaxies, clusters of galaxies, all the light is really on glued, if I may say so, on the brain. In this type of example, type of brain world universes. Now, if you measure for observation a cosmological constant, that cosmological constant will actually get two contributions. One from the bulk, one from vacuum energy in the bulk, and what I call M5 is the five-dimensional Planck scale, and another contribution from the vacuum energy on the brain, which is just the brain tension, sigma squared, and that's quadratic in the vacuum tension of the brain, in the brain tension. And so really, if lambda, the cosmological constant observed on the brain, is small, that means that there is some sort of cancellation between these two sources of cosmological constant, the vacuum energy in the bulk, in the extra dimensions, and the vacuum energy on the brain. And so, that old fine-tuning problem that you had before, is you recover it here. You just have to require some fine-tuning between the individual case between lambda b and sigma. On the other hand, the positive, if you see it from the positive side, that means that really the cosmological constant problem is not completely related with vacuum energy on the brain. So that the vacuum energy, you might have some non-vanishing vacuum energy in the brain, so where you observe, and still have a vanishing cosmological constant. Whereas in the case of a purely four-dimensional universe, there is a direct connection between the vacuum energy and the cosmological constant. In this case, this formula tells you that there's not a direct connection between the vacuum energy on the brain in our four-dimensional observed universe and the cosmological constant that you measure. So that might leave some hope for new solutions. One solution which was proposed is the concept of self-tuning. Well, basically now the idea is that you have to put some dynamics into the game, and basically some dynamics that couple the brain with the bulk. And so several types of dynamics have been proposed. One of them is to put a scalar field in the bulk, and that's the idea of self-tuning. And the name of the people would... Okay, yeah, that's the name of it's Arkanyamed Dimopoulos, Scalloper Syndrome, Kashru, Schultz, and Silverstein. So the idea is the dynamic that would couple the brain to a bulk is some scalar field which lives in the bulk, and which has some potential energy, and what is known as a conformal coupling to the matter on the brain. So if you want, really, this is the dynamics that couples both to the brain and, of course, to matter and to gravity. To matter on the brain and to the bulk and to gravity in the bulk. Now, what these people have found, they found static solutions which are spatially flat. So that would be our old Minkowski space-time. And they find such solutions for any value of the brain tension. So that means that's what I was telling you before. You might still, because now you have decoupled the vacuum energy on the brain from the cosmological constant that you observed, you might very well find flat solutions. So that means just a solution with vanishing cosmological constant, even though you have a non-vanishing vacuum energy on the brain. And one example is, a scalar field with vanishing potential in the bulk, and conformal coupling which is exponential. And here are the solutions of the couple Einstein and scalar field equations. The field is, of course, as a dependence in the extra dimension that you see here. And similarly, the metric coefficients, the four-dimensional metric, as a dependence in y. That means that if you look at a slice at constant y, then you'll see that the metric is depending on y. Now, the most important thing that led to many discussions was the fact that you have a singularity. So that means that this solution is singular at some yc. And so what was not clear in the beginning was whether this was a fundamental problem or just, you could evade this problem somehow by finding a more clever solution. So in other words, the fact that you find flat, you seem to, at least to a certain degree, avoid the cosmological constant problem, is it related to the fact that you have a solution which actually does not make sense and has a singularity somewhere in the bulk? And one of the arguments was the following, which was due to Niles and collaborators. One way of getting rid of the singularity is to hide it. And one way to hide it is to put a second brain somewhere close. Now, just imagine you put a second brain somewhere close and that your space-time is now as two ends of your universe, this brain and the other brain, which is here. Now, what these people showed was that actually, if you want to do that, you can do that, and then you'll be protected because that will be outside your high-dimensional universe. But the trouble is that you have to fine-tune matter on the second brain in such a way as to recover this solution, and the fine-tuning is exactly the sort of fine-tuning that you were trying to avoid in the case of a cosmological constant. That means the fine-tuning that you have to make on the matter content of the second brain is exactly the fine-tuning you're trying to get rid of to solve the cosmological constant problem. So that gives you an idea that probably you've just been hiding the fine, in this simple solution, you have been hiding the fine-tuning into the singularity. What we did recently in this context was to try to look at solutions in a slightly more complicated case, which is that to try to include one loop corrections to gravity in the bulk. And what we took as corrections to gravity in the bulk is to put some higher derivative terms. That means terms which are quadratic in curvature, and to take the so-called Gauss-Bonnet combination, because this is what you you would be getting at least in some cases in the context of string theory. One of the motivations to try to see if this type of higher order corrections would lead to new solutions that with no naked singularity. And because then this way you could try to study this system. And similarly, what we found afterwards, but that could be the motivation to our, that could have been a motivation to our work if we had known that earlier. In the context of cosmological solutions, this type of corrections where we're considered something like 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago, by Antoniadis and collaborators to try to get some singularity cosmological, free cosmological solutions. So those are singularities in time. In this case, what I'm trying to cure is singularity in the extra dimension. Now, it turns out that you find solutions without any singularities. Just look up here. This is similar to what I was presenting you before. This is the value of a field as you move in the extra dimension. And before there was a minus sign. There was a minus sign. And this is the metric coefficient also as you move in the extra dimension. And you see that now you find solution with a plus sign, which means that you're fine and you don't have a singularity at y equals yc. And you can, there is an extra parameter here, which is related to the, you can relate to the value of the vacuum energy in the bulk. And there is no real fine tuning between this thing. That means that at least for a large range of values of lambda b, you can find an x parameter. Now, the reason you were taking a minus sign in the previous case was in order to have effective four-dimensional theory that makes sense. That means a finite Planck scale. In this case, you can find out that even with a plus sign, you get a finite Planck scale. So you're safe from that point of view. Now, the problem that you find with this nice solution is that you got rid of a singularity problem, but then you recover a fine tuning. So that goes exactly in the same direction as people were saying. You have some sort of by adding quantum corrections to gravity in the bulk. You found a new set of solutions which are free from singularities and where the four-dimensional theory makes sense. The trouble is that immediately as soon as you do that, then you recover a fine-tuning. So it seems that it's going in the direction that these self-tuning ideas were really hiding the fine-tuning in the singularity. Instead of putting a scalar field in the bulk, some people have proposed to replace it by another dynamics, which would be a black hole configuration. And the idea is that in the case of a black hole, the singularity is hidden by a horizon. So if you have enough parameter to work with your black hole, and for example, in the case of paper like Saki, Ehrlich, and Grosjean, they took a charged black hole, then in this case, you have enough parameter to avoid fine-tuning. So in a sense, that would mean that if you're changing the vacuum energy of your brain, the charged black hole is somewhat reacting to this, and the complete dynamic is such that it doesn't touch the cosmological constant. Of course, you would have to explain why the two dynamics are coupled, but that's one way of getting rid of the singularity problem by really just doing what you do with standard black hole and hiding the singularity between horizons. There are two horizons here because it's a charged black hole. Now, getting back, does that lead to any observations? That might lead, some of these solutions might lead to some violations of Lorentz invariance. Again, that's a common trend in all these solutions. And has been studied by many authors. Well, the basic idea, some of these models were just rejected on the basis that You know, they lead to two strong violations of Lorentz invariance. Most of these models, if I write the complete metric in five dimensions, in these higher dimensional theories, then I was telling you that the metric, four-dimensional metric, which is here, dt, dx, is depending on y. And so, for example, in the case of a black hole configuration, h of y would just, you know, be a function would describe the black hole configuration. And so that shows you that if you look at the four-dimensional metric here, for different values of y, then you see that it's, you know, of course, it will be y-dependent. And that tells you that if you have two, well, if you have, for example, a distant cluster of galaxy, we are here, and there is a distant cluster of galaxy, of course, you receive light through the brain, because light is stuck to the brain. So the value of the speed of light is c. But gravitational waves will be, can't go into the bulk and come back. And so depending on, how far, how deep they get go into the bulk, then they will have different speed. And so that just means that the speed of gravitational waves, which is, it's as if gravitational waves were penetrating into a medium with a different index of diffraction. And so you might expect that when, first of all, if you see gravitational waves, that gravitational waves will come at a different speed from the speed of light. And so that might lead to some observable effects, depending, of course, on the model that you have put up on the table.
Is it possible the gravitational wave signal would disappear because the waves would get dispersed? In this picture, gravitational waves, the way you've drawn it, they
yes.
go outside and they take the long way.
No, you'll be losing some of them. But remember that you have lots of modes of, you have all the Klein-Zeckerlein modes. When you add everything, then you'll still get. Remember that the gravitational, all these models are such that, you have one mode which is, basically localized. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about, in this case of this. Well, to be more specific, it depends on the type of model that you're looking. I mean, you could have, model with two brains or model with single brain. Just imagine that a model with a single brain and four-dimensional gravity localized. What means localized is actually just not mean completely localization. But still, the wave function of the gravitational wave is fairly well peaked. And so you'll be losing some of it, of course, in the bulk. But you have to be consistent with, these models are such that they are consistent with the foundational gravitational force.
What about production of gravitational waves? If we've got in spiraling binders, we've got a binary pulsar.
So in principle, that's somewhat modified, I think, and that puts some constraint on the scale, for example, of these models.
Has that been worked out?
I think it has been worked out. Probably not in many details, but I think it's been worked out, yes.
Here, isn't it going to be the case that if you break Lorentz invariance in any part of the theory due to the usual virtual effect, it's going to be broken everywhere, so that when you look at quantum corrections, you'll find that the limiting speed for electrons and for photons is different? And you won't have to, it won't just be in gravitational experiments, right? I can think about some virtual loop that involves gravitons, but at low energy, the
and so you think that would put some limit on the? In principle.
There's a large number of, the usual attitude towards symmetries is that if you break a symmetry at all, then due to virtual effects, you'll break it in all possible terms. And sometimes because of the five-dimensional geometry, things are suppressed, but. Again, the obvious question is, if Lorentz invariance is not a symmetry of the world, why do relativistic electrons and photons move at the same speed? There will certainly be some kind of virtual effect that makes those speeds different.
So you would expect that would be of gravitational,
right.
Times the gravitational coupling, so that probably would be very small.
But it's a virtual effect, and so, large loop, once you get loops up near the Planck scale, the effect is of order one.
Mm-hmm.
mean, that's the way field theory works.
Yes.
That even if the symmetry is initially broken only at very high energy, it propagates down, you know, everywhere. And I'm just very, 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 very suspicious of any, you know, theoretical framework that violates Lorentz invariance. I don't think anybody really has tried to ask this question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's right. Probably, I mean, if you wanted to address this, then you would have to tell exactly, you know, why the electron is localized. And of course, you know, either you go to geostring theory, or you try to, you know, localize the electron, you know, doing what, you know, Rubakov, for example, is doing, and then try to address this. Because you need a complete scheme, otherwise.
Even a model, any two particles on the brain, you know, if you like the real electron.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if there's no symmetry that requires it, we'll have different speeds of light. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess there's models where somebody could calculate it if they.
Yeah, I think that's you would need a model, yeah.
There are people who study it, like getting constant light even in the studies violations of Lorentz invariance.
Yeah, he's pretty careful. But I'm not sure, has he looked at this particular sort of scheme? I mean, he's certainly aware of what the problems are. Yeah.
So would you look at Ulam storage rings or
something? Well, actually, I don't know what the experiment is, but I know Ted Jacobson, who was here a couple weeks ago, claims that there are experiments that measure Lorentz invariance to 1 part in 10 to the 20th. I'm not sure if that's Ulam storage rings or what. But, you know, that really means that there has to be an enormous suppression for any, you know, not just powers of alpha, but powers of things which are parametrically small. Mm-hmm. For any such effect. I mean, here there's a model, and I really think it's probably a calculation that some graduate student could do.
So in the remaining minutes, I'll be talking about quintessence. How much?
Well, we had a brief break for pizza. So
5 minutes? Oh, okay. So quintessence, so the idea is now to replace some, I talk about dynamical models already, but to replace it by this cosmic constant by a dynamical component, time-dependent component with negative pressure. And, you know, as we heard, we have observational constraints on the equation of state of such a component that W would have to be smaller than minus 0.5. Now, there are several candidates. You could have a network of light non-intercommuting topological defect, in which case, you know, depending on the dimension of the defect, W is minus n over 3, so n equals 1 for cosmic strings, 2 for domain world, and so on. You could have very light pseudo-Goldstone bosons, and you could have a scalar field which is evolving in its potential.
The network of cosmic strings doesn't act as
that. Okay, but
that acts like as a p equals minus 1/3.
Yes. So that would not. I didn't mean to say that cosmic string would work. Just that you know, it was giving a general formula. So it's. So the typical model would be, you know, you have used the Flacker field model, but the typical model would be a scalar field which evolving down its, you know, potential energy, and assuming the potential energy is going to zero at infinity. This is a situation that often occurs in supersymmetry of supergravity. I told you that. Before that, you have lots of flat directions of a scalar potential, and then you have to sort of, you know, break this flatness of a valley of a potential by breaking supersymmetry. And if you break supersymmetry dynamically, that means through some strong interaction, then quite often you get this type of behavior. So a potential that decreasing all the way to infinity. And, you know, basically for large values of the field phi, you recover the flat direction. So that's why it's really falling to zero at infinity. And, you know, for a long time we've been playing with this type of potentials. And usually what we're trying to do is to get minimum at some point, so that we try to do like this, and the potentials would then decrease all the way to zero at infinity, and try to hide the fact that actually you had this not very nice behavior here. So you were assuming from the point of view of cosmology that the evolution of the universe was such that you were falling this minimum, and not falling in the later, in the large field part of the potential. Of course, now with quintessence and with the reacceleration of the universe, you might precisely try to use this type of potential to do the job. And so what happened in the case of this potential here is that you find some solutions, you're attracted to some solutions where the energy density in the field phi rho phi over rho b is increasing with time, and when the field gets to values of order of a Planck scale, then it slows down and it starts emerging from the background. Rho b is the background energy density, say some matter or radiation. And for this type of potential, you end up with W parameter, equation of state parameter, which has at least a negative part plus some corrections, which depend on the power of the field phi. And so you might, you might work out some models coming from particle physics, which have a nice property of having, for example, W phi equals minus 2/3, which would be a nice value. So this is, I would say, fairly natural in the context of supersymmetry and supergravity, and in the context of models where supersymmetry is broken dynamically. There are some recent models which have been discussed, which have some nice properties. There is a model of K-essence by Mukhanov, Steinar, and Amanda Espikon, which addresses the question of the why now. So these models use non-linear kinetic terms. So that means kinetic terms for the scalar field, which are much more complicated than the standard normalized kinetic terms that we usually use. And the motivation again is string theory, although so that you have higher derivative terms that might mimic this the function that you want, although they need certain type of functional dependence in the derivative of field phi, which I'm not sure you easily find in the context of strings. But the nice thing is that it's actually once you reach a matter-dominated era that the field phi starts to dominate. So it's really the fact that you have reached a matter domination that starts rho phi to evolve and to eventually dominate. So that's one nice model from that point of view. Another model is the so-called runaway dilaton. The dilaton, I mentioned it earlier, is this field whose value fixes the string coupling and from that the gauge couplings. Now, people immediately thought about using the dilaton for quintessence. So, because there is a flat direction associated with it, and because the dilaton is not as exactly the when you try to break supersymmetry, in most cases you get when the problem is when called a runaway dilaton. So that means the dilaton is running away. And because the value of the dilaton is fixing the string coupling and the gauge coupling, that would mean a very strong time dependence of the gauge couplings, for example. So that's unwanted, and that's known as the problem of unstable runaway dilaton. Recently, Veneziano and collaborators have proposed is that instead of, I should have said that the value of infinite dilaton is the value of a very weak coupling. So that would mean that if we're in this phase, then the couplings would be weaker and weaker. But of course, there would be a very strong time dependence of, for example, the fine structure constant. What they propose is actually the quintessence field is a dilatant, but it's going to stronger and stronger coupling. And of course, we don't know exactly what alpha field looks like in a very strong coupling. For infinite values of infinite values of string coupling, but we assume that life is just as it looks like in this limit. So we assume that you reach some saturation limit where the value of the grand unified coupling, or if you want the Planck structure constant, has the right value, and also the value of the Planck scale has the right value also. And in this case, we can use the dilaton, and you don't expect in this case to have such large time dependence of the of your coupling. Of course, then you have to explain why, even though you would have this new component of dark matter, which would be, this dilaton field that you get for free in the context of strings, you still have to explain why, in this regime of a theory, you have vanishing cosmological constant, because quintessence never explained the cosmological constant problem. Quintessence has many problems, I should say, and they were very nicely raised by David Live and Chris Calder. And the main problem is that the quintessence field must be extremely weakly coupled to ordinary matter. There are several ways to see that. First of all, I told you that the potential should be decreasing to zero. But of course, as soon as the quintessence field is coupled to matter, then you'll get extra corrections, higher order corrections will tend to be large as the field gets to large values, and so that tends to raise the potential at large field values. Second thing is that the quintessence field must be very light. In the type of model what I was telling you, one of the phi alpha potential, the mass of the scalar field has to be of the order of the orbital parameter, so that's 33 electron volt in energy scale. So you have to explain this, and this will lead, of course, to long-range forces. And so, if you want these long-range forces to be not observable, then you need to couple very weakly the quintessence field to ordinary matter. Such a small mass actually maybe is favoring the pseudo-Goldstone boson version of quintessence, because it's somewhat easier to explain when you have in the case of if you have a symmetry with some small amount of breaking, it's easier to explain some very small mass. And moreover, it's difficult to find a symmetry which would prevent coupling your quintessence field to gauge field, and there are very strong limits on that coupling. And so you really have to kill this type of coupling, which would be some sort of axion coupling. And again, it's difficult to find a symmetry which would prevent such a coupling. So, and I don't think any of the quintessence model, at least any other quintessence model that I know, has really dealt in a satisfactory way with these problems of the coupling of a quintessence field to ordinary matter, even in the context of extra dimensions. How to test experimental quintessence? Probably the best way is to test the redshift dependence of the equation of state, because the quintessence model have W, which changes over the range 0 to 2, but as was discussed in the conference, time variation of couplings, because as soon as you have a scalar field which varies with time and its potential, it leads to possible variation, time variation of couplings, and possibly variation of equivalence principle. The model Veneziano at collaborators has also some variation of the equivalence principle, which has been discussed in a paper by Damour. And to conclude,
there's another test, the Sean Carroll test about rotation of polarization from radial sources.
Yes.
So if there is this coupling that they've been trying to get rid of, which is phi, F-B-N-U, tilde.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Like
Yes, I was assuming that that found one way of getting rid of it, but the trouble is that it's already, I think in most models, it's already too strong, you know, this coupling to, but you're right, absolutely. In principle, if you were succeeding in getting rid of most, I mean, putting this within the experimental limits, then this would be a very nice test, yes. Conclusions. Okay, so at least until now, supersymmetry is the only symmetry argument that would protect the vacuum energy. So is it a sign that supersymmetry is good in most of our universe and that we are unlucky and that we are living in a part of the universe where supersymmetry is not, is broken? Well, that's, I leave it up to you to decide. String theory provides a tight framework for a large number of new or so not so new concepts, and I try to discuss some of them. So you could just take extra dimension brain scalar fields, tensor field, and so on, the general context, saying okay, you found them in some string models. But as soon as you really want to work in a string theory context, then of course you cannot do anything that you want, and you are somewhat tightly constrained, at least when you work in a given theory. And it's only a worry that if string theory is a quantum theory of gravity, it has not come with a solution that would just say, you would just see it and you know that it's the right solution, because that's certainly, you expect that from the ultimate quantum theory of gravity. So, okay, does that mean that we're missing something or that the theory needs some major modifications? That I don't know. Okay, thanks.
How does quintessence avoid the no-go theorem that you mentioned in your introduction?
How does quintessence? It does not, because quintessence does not explain the cosmological constant problem. So basically, you have to assume that there is some mechanism that is flushing the vacuum energy. And then on top of that, you have a dynamical component that explains the late reacceleration of the universe. So quintessence is really not explaining the vacuum energy problem.
The vanishing vacuum energy.
Because now there are, in a way, two vacuum energy problems. One which is, what's this, I mean, so in the case of quintessence, you would first have to relax the vacuum energy, and then you would have this dynamical component that would be slow relaxing to zero also.
Isn't it true also that the no-go theorem applies to setting lambda to zero, is that right?
Yes.
But lambda is not zero, it's small.
That we don't know. We know that universe is reaccelerating.
But if lambda proves to be small, doesn't it mean that no-go
Okay, so you'd have, well, I think it will be very difficult to show that actually lambda is, when I'm saying lambda, I'm saying, really a cosmological constant. It will be very difficult to prove that there is a non-vanishing cosmological constant, because it could also be some dynamical component that is really, relaxing, I mean, which is evolving very slowly. But if you could prove that, I don't think, I mean, it would still be relevant in the sense that you could say that, there's some sort of approximate symmetry that, on the scale of the particle physics that is relaxing. So it will still be useful, though it would not completely, address the problem, of course. But I think it's really difficult to prove that. It's much easier to prove that there's a dynamical component than the real cosmological constant.
It's probably impossible to prove it's pure.
Yeah.
That's a crazy question.
Sure.
Have you heard anything about testing the granularity of space-time with atomic beams?
Yeah. you want an after dinner talk about that? No, I didn't. No. Can you tell us more about that?
There's an atomic physicist at Yale named Mark Kasevich, and he was telling me about these experiments that they can do where they take an atomic beam, they split it, and then they interfere it against each other. So people used to do this with neutrons to test the gravitational redshift. But he was saying that with the atomic beams, you can get so much better precision that you can actually test whether there are small-scale variations in the gravitational field. Not that I ever heard anybody talk about small-scale variations in the gravitational field, but...
I see. No, I'm not aware of that.
You mentioned that there is a model which supposed that there is a black hole in the extra dimension which
yes.
is used to hide the singularity.
Yes.
But you said that maybe there is a gravitational wave emitted from the brain and received from the other side. But due to the black hole existence there, is it possible to decay of this kind of gravitational wave, and when you receive it, you will not that strong signals as it emitted? I don't know whether there is...
Well, you mean the amplitude would be...
Because of the black hole absorption, it will decay the black the gravitational wave. I don't know whether there is someone studying this, compared these two waves, when it emitted and when it received. Whether there is somebody to do this, I don't know.
Probably it will be difficult to observe. I think
because...
Yeah, you
if
but
the black hole exists there, sure, it will absorb the gravitational wave. And if you study, for example, quasi normal moods and this kind
no,
of stuff.
But you would have to, in order to observe it, you have to have one way of knowing the amplitude of the gravitational waves,
yeah.
You know, at the point where, you know, something, you know, happened, and then to measure it. So you'd have, two measures of amplitude. One on Earth and the other one where, you know, whatever, where there was some collapse. It's somewhat easier in the case of, if there was something like difference in the light, between the speed of light and speed of gravitational wave, you could imagine that, you know, something happens and then you see it different time scale with light, and you see it, then you see it with gravitational waves. But in your case, you would really have to compare the amplitude, which is not easy, I would think.
Maybe we should thank Pierre again and figure out how to pay Chris.
$1 per slice and $1 per soda will do fine. If you have it, if you don't have change, don't worry about it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.